Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2019. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Robert Bob Cornelius, spelled C-O-R-N-E-L-I-U-S. My name is Tom Martin. This is a part 16 interview with Bob. And Bob, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Great. May we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Absolutely,
Thank you very much. Last time we met, we were thinking that today we might talk about the Park Service relationship with the Bureau of Reclamation there at Kier County, and the differences in local rules, local Park Service rules, versus the Code of Federal Regulations coming out of Washington, D.C. So could you start speaking to that?
Yeah, we had, the way the CFR operated is rules are made, a lot of times they're generated from the park level. There'll be a specific problem. As you know, recreation is always changing, and so to address that, a lot of times you have to have new regulations. We didn't have drones 20 years ago or 25 years ago, and they've had to address that problem in some of the parks.
Right.
And when I first started with the Park Service, the CFR was starting to go out of date, I guess. This was in the mid-70s, there were things in there that we had that needed to be updated. And one of the ways they addressed this was by Congress modifying the Code of Regulations so that the local superintendents had more control over specific things that occurred in their parks, one of which, could be drones, for example, as I just said. But things like hunting in recreation areas, you'd want to have areas where you could hunt and areas where you couldn't hunt. You wouldn't want to say that you could just hunt in a recreation area and have people, shooting around buildings, parking lots, campgrounds, all those different things. And one thing that we did was it allowed us to adopt state law as federal law,
okay,
as far as hunting and fishing regulations went. And that was very beneficial. When I was at Dinosaur National Monument, I did a lot of hunting enforcement there, because we actually had a right of way that went up to the national park, and we were trying to keep people out of the park, obviously hunting, but they could hunt on BLM lands either side of our right of way, and so
right,
we would have we would have check stations. We'd man check stations with the Division of Wildlife and stuff like that. It wasn't that they were hunting in the parks, but they were doing illegal hunting, and it was, since we didn't have a very good federal system, we would handle things through the state. I think we've talked about that maybe once before.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, when you were enforcing the CFR, if you had some different options, you could write a violation notice, hand it to the person, and say, you either have to appear in court. There were certain mandatory appearances, for example, this would be before a federal judge. They're mandatory, and this was all the different parks I was in, for like DUI, driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs was always a mandatory appearance. And other things could be handled, either you could choose to appear, or you could bond out, and you're basically saying, I'm not guilty, but I don't want to show up in court, and the maximum fine was going to be, $25, $50, whatever it was, and I'll just pay that, and it's more of a convenience type thing. And things that the superintendent could do, we had quite an extensive compendium. This started when I was at Kerr Canyon, Black Canyon, and we spent, you know, many, many hours poring over maps. We would make, that was one of the ways that you did it, is you had maps that were available for public inspection, or little copies of the maps that we would take around and hand out to hunters or fishermen or whatever. And so things that were put in the compendium that the superintendent developed were easier to get out to the public, get information, and we'd have maps on bulletin boards and things like that too, that would show where people could or couldn't hunt or fish.
Okay.
And one of the areas that was always interesting was the Bureau of Reclamation worked with the Division of Wildlife kind of separately, and they wanted to have closures a certain distance back from their dams at Blue Mesa, Morrow Point, and Crystal. And these were areas where they didn't want people fishing because it would interfere with their operation of the dams. They didn't want people fishing up over the tops of the dams. Although that was done initially at Blue Mesa. They could fish off they were fishing right off of the penstocks there and stuff. But and on the face of the dam. But they stopped a lot of that after 9/11. They
right.
gated it all off and everything because that was allowing access to, you know, areas of the dam that were kind of sensitive. And one of the interesting things that happened was that there were certain guys in the Bureau of Reclamation that enjoyed the fact that they could access areas that the general public couldn't.
Ah.
And so on a number of occasions we caught Bureau people fishing in the closed area. And this was particularly happened during the Kokanee salmon would run up. You know, they were put into the lakes. They'd bring the trucks out from Roaring Judy Hatchery, and they'd put the fish in the lakes, and then the fish would generally go back to those areas. But those that went through the made their way somehow through Blue Mesa Dam, and they get down in Morrow Point Lake and stuff. They would run them back up toward the dam, and so you get these kokanee runs up toward Blue Mesa Dam in particular is where we had issues. And I remember in one case once I caught some guys down there fishing off of Blue Mesa, and one of them happened to be one of the guys that I had rescued. We talked about that last time, about this rescue on Morrow Point Lake.
Yeah.
Was one of the Garcia brothers.
Yeah.
And he happened to work at Roaring Judy Hatchery.
Okay.
He'd come down to the dam for some reason, and so here I catch a Division of Wildlife guy fishing in the closed area along with a couple of Bureau guys.
Oops. What did you do?
In this case, because of this relationship that we had, you know, here I'd save the guy's house. I just gave him a really bad tongue lashing, told him that, you know, you work for the Division of Wildlife, you know better, you know, get out of here. So, basically, probably should have written him a violation notice, you know, but sort of I didn't want to play, I guess, Jekyll and Hyde. You know?
Yeah, gosh, but that puts you in quite the difficult dilemma. I mean, here again.
Well, it does, yeah. And I think I remember a Division of Wildlife guy one time told me, he said, "I don't play with my job." And I thought, you know, that's really good philosophy. You know,
yeah.
You need to treat everybody the same.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's just a a good way to work. I also was in a meeting with another division of wildlife guy, and I asked them before hunting season, I said, who should we be looking out for? You know, there are particular people like from Olathe or Delta or Montrose that are kind of notorious characters. And he says, everybody.
Okay.
So he said, there are no innocent people when it comes to wildlife laws, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but later on, he did have another kind of an important case where the... one of the rangers from up at Blue Mesa, a guy named Ned Kelleher, and he was really a sharp guy. He came down, and I had told him, you know, where to go to where you could look down on the dam. And I said, if you see people, you know, this was like orientation. When you see people in this particular area, you know, they're in a closed fishing area, and they need to be checked out. So he went out to the viewpoint, and he looked down. He saw these guys that appeared to be fishing at the below Blue Mesa Dam, and so he drove back across the dam. The access point was on the other side at Pine Creek. He drove down the Pine Creek Road, and when he got to the gate that was supposed to be double locked, you know, you put two locks together so
right.
that both agencies can access the area. The bureau lock had locked out the Park Service lock.
Ooh.
And he thought, well, that's kind of odd. So he climbed over the fence, walked down the road, and he caught a guy by the name of Jack Sage down there and some other guys fishing in the closed area. And, of course, this was, you know, these guys are actually on duty. I mean, it's not like it's on their day off.
Wow.
And this Jack Sage was the number two man with the bureau in Montrose, so he wrote him a ticket, and Jack had to pay, I forget, $80 or $100 or something like that. Well, that was obviously a very effective deterrent to bureau people fishing after that happened, you know. And I had had incidents with this same guy. He was always kind of on the edge. And it depended on who the supervisor was or what they said in Salt Lake, whether the bureau people followed their own policy, you know. The policy basically was, you know, we can't do things on our days off or whatever that the public can't do. And Jack was always trying to go the other way on that, you know. And the first summer I was down there, I went down to the Crystal Dam, and they were still doing some construction there, and they had a fence across the road further, quite a ways down the road from where the current fence is that the Bureau has. It's about a tenth of a mile down from the dam. And I saw this boat back up in there, and there was a woman sitting in a truck. And I was looking at this boat up there, and I said, do you know who that is up there? And she says, oh, yeah, that's Jack Sage. And I said, oh, well, you know, I don't really care who he is. And I made him come. I went up the road and signaled him across. They came across, and I said, you can't fish here, you know. And that was probably my first chance to meet him and realize I was going to have some issues with him over the years. But his supervisor was a guy named Larry Anderson, and I called Larry Anderson, and I told him what was going on. And he said, well, don't, you know, just write those people tickets, you know, because they shouldn't be in there. They can't do anything the public can't do. And as long as he was the manager, that rule pretty much was followed by everybody. And then once he left, things got a little bit looser again, you know, with the bureau people. And the thing is, a lot of times, like they would go up and go out on Morrill Point Lake and fish all the time. And the thing was, they were violating policy. They weren't violating the law necessarily, because they had their own bureau boats and stuff like that up there.
Okay.
And they would go out on the lake, and they could say, well, it was a VIP tour, or we're out trying to what was the one Jack used to tell me occasionally? Go out on Morro Point Lake and do sample testing for the Division of Wildlife. How many fish are out there? Excuse like that. So I had another incident with a bureau guy. I just moved to Kirikani. I had been there about a month and a half, and I went down the Pine Creek Road toward Blue Mesa Dam, and there's a bureau guy over sawing down a cottonwood tree and bucking it up and putting it in a pickup truck. And so I contacted him, and he said, well, this is I'm cutting this tree down because it could be a hazard. It could fall across the road. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly what you're doing. And so I went up to my supervisor and I said, you know, this is going on. And I don't know what he ever did. I don't know if he contacted the Bureau of Reclamation or what, because regarding that. But I noticed that we didn't get any more trees cut down.
Hmm. Why do you think he was cutting it down?
Firewood.
Oh, really? Well, cottonwood's not real great firewood. It's going to burn fast, but hot.
But it burns. It burns clean, and it's free as far as.
Well, there is that.
There's always that aspect to it.
Okay.
So there was a lot of, contact with bureau people over the years, and it was a little bit difficult to write them violation notices in some cases because they weren't necessarily breaking the law, but they were breaking policy. And the other thing they would do is bring their families up to the top of the dams, on their days off and show them around, and that was something they weren't supposed to do either.
Right.
But that still went on. We had a really interesting meeting one time with this same guy, Jack Sage, and I can't remember his supervisor's name now, but he was kind of a good old boy, and Joe Alston and I met with them over some issue, I forget, at the Cattleman's Hotel in Gunnison, and we decided we're going to have lunch and discuss some things, and we sat down and had lunch, and both of these guys order cocktails, and they had a couple of cocktails, and Joe and I were just kind of rolling our eyes, what's going on here, but they just operated a little bit differently than the rest of us.
Yeah.
But overall, they were pretty good people to work with. I when I first got I guess every park I worked in, they kind of had the bureau had its tentacles. the Grand Canyon, they had the water releases affected all the recreation and boating, and in fact, I was down there. I guess it was about 73 or something when the federal judge, I don't know if it was Wallace Ritter or who, told the bureau that they could not put water into Rainbow Bridge National Monument.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, I was at Phantom Ranch, and the river went from a trickle to this torrent, and it was the highest that I ever saw the water when I was there, and it was way up over the boat beach and everything. In fact, after the water receded, there were a gazillion tamarisk plants coming up, along the beaches there and stuff. But that went on for, I guess, a couple of weeks at least, until it was finally decided that water could be allowed into the national monument and under the bridge. And so so that was my experience with the bureau at Grand Canyon. I never really met with any of them or anything, but the water level went up and down, and that was all a result of of Glen Canyon Dam and the releases there.
Right.
And then, of course, Dinosaur, there was the whole previous Echo Park dam controversy that had been pretty much resolved, but the Bureau was still interested, and some of the local Colorado water people were still interested in dams up there at Dinosaur, and there were a number of times we took VIP tours, or whatever you want to call them, and took people down the river that were with the Bureau and with Colorado water people.
Okay.
And I remember them talking, you know, about, you know, gee, this would be a good site, you know, or something like that,
uh-huh.
you know. And they one guy that was interesting that we took was a fellow by the name of Vern Jetley, and he lives here in Montrose, and he was the photographer for the Bureau of Reclamation.
Okay.
And the Bureau had a an office. They were still working on near at Kirkcanny in Montrose. We shared an office with them here on the east end of town, and they had a photography file there. They had this huge machine that was on. It was like a roller, gigantic Rolodex, and they had tens of thousands of pictures in this thing, and they were all cataloged. And this Vern Jetley did all of this. He was the photographer. He had a dark room there, and he took photographs all over the western United States, basically, wherever the Bureau had projects. And he had they had photos in there of the canyons here at Kirikanti and Black Canyon before the dam, and then
Wow. As
the dam, all the construction and everything. And I used to go in there all the time and look through these and make Xerox copies of them and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
especially with because of the railroad history. They had pictures of the bridges and stuff like that that were down through the canyon and all that that type of stuff. Eventually, they moved all of that photography up to Salt Lake City, and when they closed the office here, because they were still working on Silver Jack Reservoir and Ridgeway Reservoir, and that's what this office was. It had been, you know, Morro Point and Blue Mesa and all that. They had been just been the main office had been in Montrose, but
wow, okay.
They ended up finally phasing it out and. I don't know, it's a real estate office or something now. But they had a lot of just really, really interesting photographs that this Vern had taken.
I bet.
And, yeah, he's an interesting character, but he's quite elderly now. And Dinosaur, obviously, we had, you know, he had quite a bit of interest with the Bureau in the releases from Flaming Gorge. They would usually, you know, have low flows in the spring because the Yampa River, which is a natural river, is putting a lot of water downstream, and then they would increase those and then regulate them throughout the summer so that there could be boating down through there. And
So they weren't matching the Flaming Gorge releases to meet the Yampa. I mean, there's a funny relationship between the Yampa peaking and the Green peaking that meets the Yampa, because I think the Green's a little delayed on that. It's a little further north. Is that right? And it doesn't quite
peak
at the same time as the Yampa.
Yeah, and we would, you know, you'd have runnable water in the Lodore Canyon in the spring, but it wasn't the usually the flows that you had during the summer. You'd have the higher flows in the summer.
Okay.
And that was, I think that was pretty common. And then, of course, then I moved to Glen Canyon, and you know, obviously out on the big old lake there, I was kind of sad, you know, after the flooding of Glen Canyon, so there was always kind of, you know, felt that way about it. But while I was there, the lake rose, I think, to its highest pool.
Okay.
And we had, for example, you didn't have to go around Antelope Island, you know, down toward the dam and around Antelope Island to get up lake. You could go through there was a cut between the upper end of Walweet Bay there where you went, you just shortcutted everything.
Right.
And that was a pretty nice deal as far as whenever you went back and forth up lake.
And then
cut the trip.
A lot of money was put into the cut to make it deeper as the mm-hmm. reservoir level dropped. And right now it's out of the water.
Again. Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah, and then of course we also had I think I've talked about previously the security of the dam,
right.
And the tunnel and everything. We dealt with that with the Bureau. When I first moved to Glen Canyon, the city of Page was still policed by the Reclamation Police.
Oh,
and then they started a, you know, Montrose, or not Montrose, a Page Police Department. And with that, we lost our dispatching, and eventually the Park Service ended up, you know, paying for 24-hour dispatch with the police department there in Page. And we used their little jail occasionally if we had to hold somebody overnight. Mm,
okay.
And so
interesting relationships with the other agencies nearby just to save funding and not duplicate systems.
Right, right. You pay the and dispatching is that's the kind of classic. They'll have one dispatch and everybody pays money into it and to support it, and then you have your dispatch operation. We did that here in Montrose too, with the Montrose Sheriff's Department, and we also did it with the Gunnison Sheriff's Department.
Okay.
We had, dispatch operation with both, and you know, it's much more cost effective than to try to hire 24-hour-a-day dispatchers for the Park Service, or to have the supervisors, you know, act as dispatch on their days, you know, at night,
right,
in their homes or something. That a lot of parks have done that over the years, and that, you know, it's not very efficient.
No, I mean, you talked about that. I mean, it's just crazy to have people that have full-time day jobs then serve as dispatchers at night. That's just a losing proposition.
Yeah, it doesn't work. And but there were some other things with the Bureau at Glen Canyon. They had it was the first time I saw these high scalers work, and we had this one day. The Park Service pilot Warren, I can't think of his last name. His name was Warren. He was flying around. He saw this huge cloud of reddish dust, and he flew over, and it was right above Rainbow Bridge. He called me at the marina, and I think I mentioned this maybe once before, but we got everybody out of there. We closed the Rainbow Bridge, and then the high scalers for the Bureau came in and knocked a bunch of huge, you know, chunks of rock out, and these guys would hang in. They had a thing called wire rope they would use, and it was a big piece of like hemp rope that was about an inch wide or more,
mm-hmm.
And then they had a steel cable that went through the middle of that, and twisted wire, and then they would have little seats they sat on, like a little swing, and they were buckled into that, and they could move around pretty good with that, but they could also clip into another rope if they had to and stuff, and move this apparatus. And they did a lot of scaling there. And then when I was at Cura County, they were still, the high scalers were putting wire wrapping, like sort of like cyclone fencing almost.
Uh-huh.
A lot of places where there were a lot of rock fall, they would do this particularly where you had a cliff where rocks spalled off, but you had workmen or a power plant or something like that below that could, you know, have severe damage and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They did, you know, hundreds and hundreds of square yards of this stuff.
Huh. Okay.
But the first time I saw them was at Glen Canyon after that big slide and a rock fall. And they also, they had a big boat. They had a Uniflight. It must have been about 36 maybe feet long, maybe,
wow,
maybe 40 foot long. And they used that to scoot all over the lake. And we used it a couple of times in, they, you know, if it was up up lake, we could get a hold of them, and they provided like ambulance service, sort of, you know. I remember a couple of times I went on their boat so that we could get down lake faster.
Okay.
And so that was a benefit of the having the Bureau there, I guess.
Yeah.
And also the Park Service took over the old Bureau of Reclamation, one of their buildings in Page, for their headquarters for a long time, and that's where they were at when I was working there before they built their new park headquarters.
Okay.
You know, south of the dam and all. And let's see. Oh, I wrote one little note down here. Doesn't have anything to do with the Bureau of Reclamation. But there was this one incident that occurred at Glen Canyon. We had these people that were, there was a little gang. It was called the Huddleston Gang. Have you ever heard of them?
No.
And the Huddleston Gang were a group of people that were related with that last name.
Okay.
And they were going around. The reason I thought about this is because we had these huge parking lots at Glen Canyon, and we were having a lot of car burglaries where people would break into cars when people were out on the lake and steal things out of the cars.
Oh.
So we were doing a lot of patrols, and you'd go, you know, sit in your patrol car out there and watch the parking lots, or you'd walk around the parking lots at night. And what the Huddleston Gang, they figured out what they were doing, and they went to parks all over the West, is they would camp somewhere outside of the national parks, and then they would take motorcycles, and they would drive into the parks, and they would do this at night. And then they would do things like they'd put socks over their shoes and stuff to kind of tamp down the noise of them walking around. And they would walk right into people's campsites and steal stuff. And they were also doing these car burglaries. And they would use motorcycles because they could get away really quickly. And they they weren't as obvious on them, maybe, you know. But I always remembered one night I was out patrolling one of the parking lots near the Waweep Lodge, and I startled someone that was probably breaking into a car, and they ran, got on a motorcycle, and took off, and I chased them, but I couldn't catch them. And I always wondered if that was one of the Huddleston. They eventually caught them, and they all went to prison for a, you know, long time.
Uh-huh.
But they, just a kind of an aside, didn't have anything to do with the Bureau of Reclamation, but I always wondered if I almost broke the Huddleston case. You know?
But no, that's an interesting issue of long-term parked cars in lots all across the West at all kinds, mm-hmm, of service areas, recreation areas, national parks and monuments, campgrounds. So it's,
well, people's guard is often down when they're in a park. You know,
mm-hmm,
they you know, you leave stuff out on your picnic table, and you go recreate during the day, and you don't think anything about it. You come back, and
right.
you know it's like they're in a different world than the real world, but actually they're in the real world
because right.
people still steal and do bad things. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see. Well, when I moved to Montrose, you know, the Kerr Canyon, Black Canyon, the Power Operations Center was in Montrose, and one interesting thing happened when there was a reorganization of government when the Department of Energy was developed or instituted or whatever you want to say, and the Department of Energy took over the operation of all the power lines, and the Bureau then strictly produced the power at the dams and took care of the reservoirs.
Okay.
And so I think it was, I don't remember if it was Jimmy, I don't think it was Jimmy Carter. I forget which president it was under. But they decided to, it would have been Carter was quite a bit earlier, wasn't he? Must have been the Clinton administration. They decided they wanted to rename the Bureau of Reclamation and other agencies to make them, you know, what am I trying to say? More reflect what their mission was, I guess.
Hmm.
And so the Bureau of Reclamation became the Water and Power Resources Services. And I remember the outside of their office here in Montrose, they had this huge sign. It was made out of redwood. Bureau never did anything halfway, you know. It was redwood, heartwood, and it was all routed out. Beautiful sign, Bureau of Reclamation. Well, they took that down.
Wow.
And they put this new sign up, West, you know, Water and Power Resources Services. We call them, we teased them when we'd call them the Whoppers, and they didn't like that. And this was something, the Bureau of Reclamation, you know, tradition in a government agency sometimes is very important, and to be called the Bureau of Reclamation was really important to them.
Hmm.
And they groused about this for years. And I'll never forget when they went back, they reverted back to call them the Bureau of Reclamation after 4 or 5 years or whatever it was. And the day that was signed, that legislation or executive order or whatever was signed, they tore that other sign down and put the old Bureau of Reclamation sign right back up.
Huh.
I mean, that was like priority one for the Bureau of Reclamation in
yeah.
the United States.
Yeah.
Get that sign up, you know. So they, but I just always thought it was interesting because it was you know, the tradition in, you know, federal agency is something that's so important to some people.
Bob, I'm curious. Do you see a day when, given the advances in wind power and solar power and just advances in gas-fired electrical generation turbines, do you see a day when the Bureau of Reclamation may take on a new mission of decommissioning some of their dams?
Well, they have. I don't know if they have done it, but there have been dams decommissioned in some places for other purposes, you know, like up in the Northwest for
yep.
salmon and stuff going up the lakes. But I you know, hydropower is pretty efficient, and we right here in Montrose, the water that comes from the Gunnison Tunnel, if
uh-huh.
you're familiar with that, from East Portal out, they have put a hydro plant out here on the canal. There's one place it comes out of a tunnel, and then it makes a really sharp drop.
Okay.
And on that spillway there, they've put a hydro plant. So it's small, but they're I'm not sure. I think it was probably Bureau of Reclamation funded, but I'm not quite sure who is operating. I think the Uncompahgre Valley Water Users Association.
Uh-huh.
And they have an interesting, you know, they're a private irrigation company, but all the works were built by by the Bureau of Reclamation, and they were always interesting to deal with because if they they could always kind of tell you, well, that's, you know, we'll have to check with the Bureau on that, you know.
Uh-huh. Yep.
They could stall you on a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
We had a meeting one time, or several meetings, actually. We came up with a memorandum of understanding with the Bureau of Reclamation on how the East Portal Road that goes down to the bottom of the canyon, the Uncompahgre Valley water users' properties, and the roads in both directions, one going up to the Crystal Dam and one going down to our campground, how all that area was going to be managed. And the Bureau didn't want a lot of Park Service regulations and environmental issues. They wanted to be able to keep the road open so they could get to the dam, you know, under any circumstances,
mm-hmm.
basically. And you get a tremendous amount of rock fall down there. So they wanted to have places where they could take the rocks and toss them off the side of the road. And in a couple cases, they built whole parking lots along the road, you know, because there was so much debris. What
wow.
do you do with it?
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be, you got to get it out of the river. They're always sensitive about anything that went into the river that could push water up back up into the power plant and,
right.
and decrease the power plant efficiency and stuff like that. And so we came up with this memorandum of understanding, and they basically agreed to have a corridor, and we agreed to have a corridor along this road. And the Bureau could do anything they wanted, basically, along the road. They could chop down trees if they needed to. They could move rocks and that sort of thing. And, you know, the benefit to the park, for one thing, is that the park didn't have to maintain the road. The Bureau maintains the road.
Okay.
And it also delineated the boundaries of the water users' properties, so that they weren't, you know, doing things that were impinging on the Park Service's mission or vice versa.
Uh-huh.
And we also were given a building down there that we use for quarters and for a little small little contact station. So everything was laid out. But that was one of those meetings where you know, a couple of us showed up and a whole bunch of Bureau people showed up. You know, it's a little bit intimidating to go into something like that. But that was probably the only time I really, really got involved with a lot of, you know, the working with the Bureau on coming up with any kinds of plans or that type of thing.
So they would.
The things that,
So Reclamation. You have a meeting with Reclamation, and they would they bring in other staff members from surrounding areas? I mean, how would they just show up with eight people?
They would bring people from Salt Lake, you know, because whenever you talk to the local guys, well, can we do this or that? There were certain things they could do and certain decisions they could make locally.
Okay.
And certain decisions they couldn't. And so they would always defer, well, I got to call Salt Lake City. And they would have the guys would fly down here and from Salt Lake City to attend meetings like this. You know, and they might have a legal person, and they would have an engineer, and they'd have, you know, different types of people like that. In fact, flying was a problem, in that they had one time they had a terrible plane crash where they I forget how many Bureau people were killed. I think there were five.
Oh, wow.
Five or six people were killed. They took off from the Montrose Airport to fly back to Salt Lake, and they had a new pilot, and the Uncapagre Plateau, which is south and west of Montrose, is kind of deceiving, in that it kind of goes up at a slow, it just gains elevation slowly, but the crest is pretty high. I don't know, it must be 8,000 feet or something up there.
Okay.
And this pilot, instead of circling and gaining altitude over the valley, he just kind of flew straight up the plateau, and didn't have enough power in this aircraft, and they crashed, and all these guys were killed. They have a memorial here in Montrose. At the I think at the Bureau of Reclamation building over there on Rio Grande, part of the.
Well, it's interesting because the National Park Service has legal representation. They have engineers, they have superintendents and assistant superintendents, and if you guys had wanted to, you could have brought in that kind of support, but clearly there was no need, and I'm just curious to know why Reclamation thought there was a need to do that. And you mentioned intimidating, and I thought, was that...
that might be part of it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's hard to say, or maybe they're just justifying their jobs, I have to respect the guys.
Uh-huh,
because
sure.
They're the only real agency in the government that makes money. They make money every time that turbine turns.
Right.
And every other agency in the federal government, I can't think of another one, is taking tax dollars and just spending tax dollars. And the Bureau is actually self-funded, and then they actually make money for the rest of the government too. So that's kind of an interesting aside, but. When I first got to Kurikani, I remember you could I made friends with all of these Bureau people. I used to go visit the people in each of the power plants, so I know who the main people were. Some of the guys I had actually worked with at Glen Canyon.
Okay.
I knew them. So they're a small agency, and they move around, like Park Service people do. And that was always kind of fun to see people again, obviously.
Yeah.
But one of the things that when I first got here, it seemed like to me that you could get some of the guys, local guys, particularly the equipment operators, to do things for you. You had a rock you wanted to move or something, so you get your boat on the lake or something. I remember doing that one time. And as time went on, they were unionized. The Bureau of Reclamation people were unionized, and everybody had their little niche, their little job. And you'd go ask somebody, "Hey, could you do this?" And they'd say, "No, I can't do that. It's against shop rules or something." And so, from that standpoint, they were they got a little bit harder to deal with on a one-to-one basis.
Mm-hmm.
They apparently were afraid to make a decision on their own and go do something. They had a specific job that they had to do.
Interesting. I kind of want to circle back around to the CFRs versus the Superintendent's Compendium, and you had mentioned something about snowmobiles and ice. The snowmobiles out on the lakes when they were frozen.
Uh-huh.
Was there a CFR that said that shouldn't happen, and then did the Superintendent's Compendium allow that?
Now it's been a long time ago, 15 years or more.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what the rules are now, but I know in our in our compendium, we came up with a map that showed the areas that snowmobiles could access the lake.
Okay.
There were just certain places where they could get onto the lake surface, and then basically the whole frozen surface of Blue Mesa Lake could be accessed, except probably right around the dams, I'm guessing. But it's been a while since.
I mean, just like a boat in the summertime, you can access the whole lake except around the dam. That makes sense.
Right. You can go about anywhere. And then, another thing would be, there's probably something in the compendium about all boats that go on Blue Mesa Lake, and you'd have to be checked for zebra.
Exotic mussels, the little clam things.
Mussels, yeah. Zebra mussels, yeah. And we had, maps of, I think I mentioned earlier about where you could and couldn't hunt, and we came up with a little rule that you could you couldn't shoot a gun like across the trail, for example, from one side of a trail to another, because of the danger, of hitting something. You had to be so many feet from a trail or a developed campground or those types of things. And,
yeah.
And then another one would be the hand-carried boats onto the two lower lakes. We didn't allow people to drive their vehicles down to the shore below Mora Point Dam, and we had this giant stairway below Blue Mesa Dam, and people would carry their boats up and down there, but it was just hand-carried boats, basically. If you could carry it down there, you could put it on the lake. And,
okay.
I had one boat one time. This guy got it down there okay, but it was, the thing weighed a ton, absolute ton. And I finally, there was no way he was going to get it out of there. And I finally said, well, I'll tow it down to the dam, Mora Point Dam, and we'll pull it up out of the lake. And we took it down to the dam, and I hooked it on. They had this big crane down there. It's one that's on railroad tracks.
Okay.
It's not and the crane goes back and forth on this gantry.
Yeah.
And so I just used that as hooked a rope over the top of it, and we just pulled this thing up using a truck, and we pulled it up out of the dam, out of the water, up onto the dam, and then hauled it down to Cimarron. The kid came and got his boat, it was. But I remember, I think we dropped it once back into the lake. You know, it didn't even dent it. It was such a monster of a thing. To a little bit more about CFR.
Yeah.
You know, we had this bond schedule, and most of the rangers didn't think that the bond schedule fit the crimes in most cases, that people were getting off with a hand, wrist slap. I remember this was really true at Glen Canyon, where people with a $500,000 houseboat wanted to park near the boat ramp. So they would just park on the boat ramp and go off for a week and leave their car parked on the ramp. Well, it would interfere with people getting their boats in and out of the lakes.
Absolutely. Really? People would do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Huh.
We had a limit, like a one-hour zone or something like that.
Right.
And
loading and unloading.
And the fine for leaving for an unattended vehicle like that, or parking over an hour or something, was like $10.
Oh, wow.
And so even if you increased it to $100 bond, if someone is determined that, I can afford to run this giant houseboat, and this is just my parking fee, basically, is the way they were handling this. So we came up with a solution, and that was to call tow trucks, and we would get tow trucks out of Page. After you did that a few times, and the word got around, then that kind of took care of that issue.
So you would tow their boat away,
tow their car back to Page, their car and if they were people that had a trailer, you tow the car and trailer.
Okay,
that becomes a huge inconvenience to them, and then they don't do it again. You know, right. So but anyway, I once. That we wanted to increase or change the bond schedule on that we had. So I called up to, I went ahead and developed this whole thing, and we, you know, checking with other rangers in other parks and locally in our own parks, what's a reasonable bond on different things. And so I got this call from, we sent it in, the chief ranger sent it in to our regional office, and I get a call from John Chapman, and when he was working in the region, he was all upset about it, and the reason he was upset about it was because he would have to take this to the U.S. attorney and get their approval, and the U.S. attorney would then have to take it to the chief federal judge in Denver, in this case, and he didn't want to go to all that work. And so he was quite upset, but he eventually did it, and we got a new bond schedule. And John Chapman later became the superintendent of the park, you know, so I guess he could have got even with me for, I gave him some work, and I'm sure he gave me some in return when he was superintendent. But that helped a lot.
How come... So you've got a bond schedule that needs to be updated, and you do that, and you show it to your boss, a chief ranger, and the chief ranger goes, yeah, it looks good. Why wouldn't that just go to the compendium for the superintendent to say, well, in this compendium in our park, this is our bond schedule?
Because he's not the judge. The judicial system sets the fine.
I see. Okay.
If it's not specifically in the law, you know. They'll usually say that 6 months or $5,000 fine or something like that.
You know,
and that sounds real scary, but for practical purposes, to make the system work, you develop bonds, and then people, you know, unless it's a real egregious thing, you say, well, you know, that's going to be their penalty, basically, if they decide not to show up in court. And so you want something that's reasonable, but still hurts a little bit, you know.
And so the compendium would deal with boundaries and area closures, but anything fine-related or court-related, that had to go through a different... So the superintendent couldn't put in a compendium about that.
Yeah, the superintendent had no control over that at all.
All right.
And we did have when I was at Glen Canyon, we did have a U.S. attorney that told us we could go ahead and we could modify the bond. The ranger in the field could modify the bond based on the egregiousness of the offense.
Really?
Let's say it was the same, you know, the same guy had done the same thing a couple of times,
right.
So instead of a $50 bond, you'd say, well, $100 bond. Well, we got away with that for a short period of time until the federal judge in Phoenix found out about it, and he was really unhappy because, you know, we're now judge and jury.
Oh, I see. Like, okay.
So that stopped, and we went back to our old ineffective bond schedule.
Okay.
Huh. But another thing that was interesting was getting a hold of people. You know, people would, and every park I was in was the same issue. You'd write someone a violation notice, and then they would take and either pay the bond or just ignore it. You know, well, I don't care about this, and like people do all the time, like the parking tickets. And so I had one interesting case at Cimarron one time, where I wrote a guy a ticket for illegal camping. He camped in a picnic area not too far from the visitor center, right in front of the sign that said no camping. And so I wrote him this ticket. It was a $25 fine. And then this was first thing in the morning. It was like 7:30 in the morning, something like that. And I went back to my office, and I parked the car, and I looked back down toward the picnic area, just in time to see this guy tear up my ticket and throw it in the trash can. And so he took off in his car and headed west toward Montrose, and I think I had actually gone in my office, and I had a window that faced the picnic area, and I looked out the window and I saw this. So I had to lock the building up, run out, get in my car, and chase him. And I caught him about halfway to Montrose, and so he pulled over, and I had actually gone down to the trash can too. I went to the trash can and got the ticket and had it with me, and then I caught him, and I asked him. I said, "Well, why'd you tear the ticket up?" And he said, "Well, he just did, you know." And I said, "Well, how are you going to know where to send the bond money and all?" He says, "Oh, I memorized all that." And I said, "I don't think so." So I got the guy in handcuffs. I said, "You're under arrest." And I got him in handcuffs, and he pleaded and pleaded with me. He was from Oregon. And I said, "Okay." I said, "I'll tell you what we'll do." I said, "We'll drive back down to the post office in Cimarron, and you will buy a money order for $25, and we'll put it in the envelope, and I'll watch you put it in the slot, and then you can go." And he said, "Okay, that was better than going to Grand Junction," because that's where we had to take prisoners.
Huh.
And so we went back, and I told Bill Newberry, the postmaster, I said, "You know, this gentleman needs to get a $25 money order." And he did. He went on his way, and everything was copacetic. But a lot of people, you know, did not always pay their violation notice. So one of the things, another thing I would do is sometimes you would catch somebody doing something, but you didn't have quite enough evidence to maybe write the violation notice at the time.
Okay.
So you would send it to them through the mail.
Right.
And I used to send them, and they went in an official government envelope, and it said, you know, U.S. Department of the Interior, National Park Service, Black Canyon National Park, or Kerr Canyon National Recreation Area, or something. And so you would send it certified, and they wouldn't accept it, and it would come back. And I thought, well, this isn't good. You know, I'm sending them a certified letter, and they see all this information on there. They know what it's about, and they just don't accept it. And so there was a woman who was our secretary down here in Montrose, and her name was Olivia Martinez. And so I told Olivia, I said, "Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I want to get a plain envelope, and we're going to put your name on it as a return address."
Oh.
And so we had O. Martinez, and then we had the Black Canyon office address on it, and we would send certified letters to people, and every time they accepted the letter, because it said O. Martinez and not National Park Service on there, and I delivered a lot of violation notices that way, and it was pretty effective. But you know, if a person was a local, they would generally pay the bond. It was people that were from out of state or something like that. They figured, well, I'll never be back there again.
Right.
Anything. we had a, I think I mentioned maybe an earlier discussion where we went, a guy decided not to pay his entrance fee to the Black Canyon. And do you recall that?
No.
That story? Well, the guy came up to the entrance station and was very upset about having to pay whatever it was, $7 or something, to go into the park. And he kind of was very rude and intimidated the young lady who was the at the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And but finally agreed that he would just, you know, turn around and go back out because he didn't want to pay the fee. Well, instead of just turning around the entrance station, he decided to go on into the park and maybe turn around at the first viewpoint or something like that. But he went down to Tamichi Point, which is the first viewpoint, and the visitor that was in back of him witnessed all of this, him berating the seasonal at the entrance station, and the guy confronted him at Tamichi Point. So, you know, what are you doing, you know? And so it embarrassed this guy. So the guy turned around and went back out. He did go back out of the park, but now he'd gone in the park and hadn't paid, see? So Nancy Zanger was on duty that day, and she chased this guy. Found him about, 10 or 12 miles from the park on Highway 50, and pulled him over and wrote him a violation notice for not paying his entrance fee. And this guy was from New York State, and so when he got back to New York, he just ignored the request to appear or pay his $25 bond.
Mm-hmm.
And so the U.S. attorney over in Grand Junction, assistant U.S. attorney in Grand Junction, they started corresponding back and forth. The guy said, well, you know, he just didn't want to pay because of this, that, and the other. And I remember the U.S. attorney calling me, and I had to write up basically a history of fee collection in the National Park Service.
Wow.
And for his information, you know. And this guy really was obnoxious, and the judge finally, the U.S. Magistrate, Magistrate Robb, finally had enough of this guy, and he put out an arrest warrant for him. And the U.S. Marshal, who was at in the courthouse over there in Grand Junction, he had a friend who was also a U.S. Marshal in New York. And so one day he pays this guy a visit, and he basically told him, you know, you either go to jail, or like I told this other guy, you either go to jail or we go down to the post office and you pay the bond. In this case, the guy just wrote a check or something handed it to the U.S. Marshal, I think, and the case was closed. But he finally did have to pay his $25, but it took, you know, clear across the country, 3,000 miles to get the... Get payment.
Right, it took, you know, $300 worth of salary time to
get. Oh yeah, I can't imagine how much money it cost the government.
Oh my gosh!
I had to make several written statements and stuff about the whole case. The first time I had to describe in more detail what had happened.
Okay.
And then the second one I had to talk about. You know, why we have fees in the national park. So it was kind of crazy.
Hmm.
Let's see. The other thing that we did at each of the parks that I was at, we didn't always have a good federal judiciary. Dinosaur was that way. and in particular. And so we handle things through state courts, and I've probably said this before, but one way we did it is we deputized our staff. So over the years, I was thinking, I've been a special deputy in Coconino County, Arizona, and Moffat County, Colorado, and Uinta County, Utah, and Gunnison County, Colorado, and Montrose County, Colorado.
Oh, interesting.
And then I was a Utah boating enforcement officer.
Okay.
So that's how you dealt with things. Through a lot of the cases we would deal with, we did through justices of the peace, you know.
Okay.
Both at Grand Canyon and Glen Canyon in particular, and then when I got here to Black Canyon, Kirikanti, they had a part-time magistrate in Grand Junction, and then a kind of a full-time magistrate over in Grand Junction as the caseload started to increase with all the federal agencies on the western slope.
Right. Yeah, you'd think there's enough federal land around Junction that one person could stay busy there.
Oh yeah, they have plenty of things going on, and we went over to federal court every month. We had to go over there, and someone had to go from the park and be over there for cases, because we almost always had a case going.
Okay.
So. Well, I've had an interesting career. So
you have.
lots of things have gone on. I'm envious of myself.
Well, and
I wish I could still do it.
as a citizen of this great country, I want to thank you for your service.
Thank you.
An amazing life and an amazing career, and so I certainly thank you for all the work you've done to preserve our resources for future generations, which your children and your grandchildren and all of our great-great, our great-grandchildren will benefit from this.
Sure. Well, it's been an honor. So. You know, I sometimes sit in awe and think, boy, I got paid to do all this stuff. You know, have all this fun. Ride these snowmobiles and drive these power boats and row down the rivers and ride horses and and hike miles on beautiful trails, you know, so... Someone's got to do it.
That's right. That's right.
As they say. I've really appreciated your patience and listening to all my windy tales and everything, Tom. So I'm looking forward to visiting with you one of these days in Flagstaff. So
that would be a lot of fun. As we wrap this up, is there anything you'd like to say? Thinking 50 and 100 years ahead to future Park Service employees?
Boy, you know, things are much different than when I started. And when I started, they were much different than they were the previous, 50 years, I guess, is when I first came in, when the 50th anniversary. And, it's a daunting task to try to allow people to visit and enjoy our national parks and monuments, historic areas, and keep them the way that they were when they were first established. And I just almost shake my head sometimes thinking how can we do this? You know, it's because there's the popularity of them. Here a few years ago, I think they thought it was waning, and it's actually increasing enormously, and there's so many things that are happening as far as population.
Right.
Whereas we used to have isolated parks, we now have communities growing up around them. I read the other day the fastest growing community in the United States is St. George, Utah.
Yeah.
And we're right outside the boundaries of Zion and not too far from from Bryce and those other areas. So I guess if I was to give any advice, it'd be, be honest and with people, and especially in law enforcement and dealing with people, try to, just do your best. If you're in search and rescue, be prepared for those types of things.
Nice.
I don't know. I don't.
That's good. Be honest.
Caught me off guard a little bit.
Be honest. Do your best and be prepared. I mean that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, Bob Cornelius, thank you so very, very much for your time. Taking the time to do these interviews. I'm really, really honored that you've done that. And absolutely, I hope to see you when you're in Flagstaff, or if we're up your way, Montrose, we'll definitely stop in and say hello.
Yeah, give me a call sometime if you get a chance, because we're we go to Flagstaff all the time. It seems like I've spent half my life down there, I think. So,
well, hold the line for a minute. Thank you very much.
Okay.